Welcome to Meet the Writers. My guest today grew up in Pembrokeshire in Wales. She's an award-winning author who lives in Cardiff. Her first novel, The Girl in the Red Coat, was shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Prize, the British Book Industry Awards Debut Fiction Book of the Year, the John Creasy New Blood Dagger, and the Wales Book of the Year. It was a Sunday Times bestseller. It's been translated into 16 different languages. She's also a short story writer and has contributed articles and reviews for The Independent, The Mail on Sunday, and The New York Times. Her second novel, The Doll Funeral, is out now. Kate Hamer, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you very much for asking me.
Now, your two books, your two novels, and of course you have a book of short stories too, but both The Doll Funeral, your latest book, and The Girl in the Red Coat, really take themes of girls with rich inner lives who've been removed from their parents. And I know that very early on in your own life, you were removed, albeit quite briefly, from yours. But it was a traumatic incident, which seems to me, reading your work, to have informed a lot of it. Tell me what happened.
Well, I was about eight, which is the age of Carmel, actually, in the first book, The Girl in the Red Coat. And my parents were off with my sister making a long trip up north, thinking of relocating, actually. And they were involved in a very traumatic road traffic accident and were quite lucky to survive, I think, particularly my mother. And the first I knew of it was my grandmother coming up. I was in bed and saying, something's happened, but I'm not quite sure what. And sort of gradually over the next couple of days, the details started to come through. So I didn't see my parents, particularly my mother, for quite a long time. Hard to quite know how long it was now, looking back, but it seemed like a long, long, long time. She was in hospital and then in a rehabilitation centre for many weeks and probably months. And I have very clear memories of that summer. It was my sister sort of took over running the household. She was about 15 at the time. Actually did it really well, considering how young she was. It was just a strange time. It was like suddenly that, you know, there was no family anymore. I kind of came and went more or less as I pleased. So yeah, I think it's probably something that's definitely that period embedded in my memory and has informed both books.
Mm. And was it a time of sort of self-exploration? Were you discovering books at that time that the rich inner life of the children and indeed of the parents in your books would appear to suggest that?
I really think I did. And I think sort of being removed from that busyness of family life where everything's ordered and organised and suddenly it just stopped, I think maybe for the first time I was very much alone with my own thoughts and ideas and, you know, for long periods of time. And so I think in a funny way it was quite formative like that. I sort of remember it as being the first time I really became aware of thought processes and imagination, and it was just so quiet, I suppose.
Mm. Do you have your own children?
I do, yes. They've grown up now, and I've always written short stories and, you know, wrote when I was a child. I think many writers would say the same. But I think it was them leaving home kind of prompted me to think I want to write more and to really put all my eggs in one basket, really, and think, you know, make a huge commitment to writing.
Because, of course, that's not what you started off doing professionally. So take us back to your education. After you finished school, you went off to university.
Yeah, I went off to university, and I don't know why, for reasons I still can't quite explain, I ended up studying history of art. through some kind of, I'm not quite sure how or where. I mean, I enjoyed it, but I think I always had this notion of wanting to write and of being fascinated by words. But I kind of, you know, at the age of 18, I had a very, very rural background as well. I mean, it wasn't sort of, you know, in London or anywhere kind of, it was in a very isolated place. So I went through lots of different kind of avenues, and I worked in radio and television for a long time, which looking back on it is actually still storytelling, you know.
Mm. So in television, I mean, that was largely documentary making.
Yes, it was. And that I had a really interesting time. It was a lot of documentaries, arts documentaries, but documentaries about people as well. And just really interesting and quite a privilege, sort of helping and enabling people to find expression for their lives as well, and extraordinary lives quite often.
So when you decided that actually what you were going to do is write, was that the point where you went on the Curtis Brown course?
Yes. Well, I went on several courses, actually. I also did an MA, which was very helpful. And with both of them, I think it was part of me making a real commitment to writing and saying, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to find out everything I can about it. So I, first of all, I did an MA and then the Curtis Brown course.
So the Curtis Brown course is quite well known. Just tell me what it is.
It's run by the agency Curtis Brown, which I think is probably, is it the biggest agency in London? I'm not sure. I think it might be. And it's restricted to 15 people, which I think is really good. So you submit your work, and if they like it, you go on the course. And I think it was really good because, well, sort of a variety of different reasons. The first one is it was great to find a writing tribe and just to sit down with people who take it just as seriously as you do and who are as passionate and stand up and read your work out for the very first time or begin to get used to doing that, because it's really nerve-wracking, you know, your voice is really quivering like this because you're so nervous. And it was very good. There were visits from agents and publishers. So you find out about the industry, which was quite mysterious from the outside.
Finding your voice is the thing that writers always say that really sparks them off. Once you've found that, you're on your way. Was that something you always knew? Did you know what your voice was?
I think I did through short stories, but I think until I tackled a novel, you know, you always think, oh, could I? I wonder if I could. Because it's a big, big project. You know, The Girl in the Red Coat probably took about 4 or 5 years altogether to write. So, yeah, I think finding your voice is key. And I think you kind of know when you have attempts at it beforehand. But when you do, you just have a feeling, I think, in the pit of your stomach. And it's not saying that's it then. It's plain sailing from then on. But it's a big step. And I would say to anybody that's writing and aspiring writers is to absolutely trust your instincts when you feel that. And I think in a way that's the biggest lesson I had all the way through, is just in terms of story, in terms of just go with your gut and trust. There's so much gut and instinct involved in writing. And I think a lot of it is learning to trust that.
But you can't just sit there and wait for the muse to descend, can you?
No. I mean, you'd probably be there forevermore if you did. Stephen King has written a brilliant... Have you read it? On writing, it's absolutely brilliant book. And he talks about his muse, but he said it's not like a little fluttery angel winged thing. It's like some grumpy old guy that lives down in the basement and smokes cigars and has got a baseball hat on, and you know, and you've got to please the muse. It's not the other way around. I think a lot of it is just sitting down, training your brain to sit down and work every day, and then I think he says hopefully the muse will show up at some point.
It must be quite difficult though when you're used to writing short stories, so your brain is trained to write to a certain length, to expand that. How do you go about that process?
I always wanted to. I always had the aspiration to write a novel, and I'm really into film. I watch lots and lots and lots of films, and when I write with both novels, I think I kind of see it like a film. It's, you know, unfolds in the same way. So I think I always had the ambition to take it to... And there's something deeply satisfying, I think. Mm. I love short stories, but there's something really deeply satisfying about working on a novel. Mm. It just immerses you for such a long time. And, I mean, it's like living somewhere else for couple of years.
And that film influence, if we could just take it a bit further. I mean, I'm interested in other things that have inspired your work, particularly because of the title of your first book, Fairy Tales.
Yes, yeah, very much so. I read a lot of fairy tales when I was little, and they just seeped into my bones. And I think those early influences don't really leave you. So, I mean, Little Red Riding Hood is the obvious one there with the girl in the red coat. You know, that kind of imagery is very powerful. And they're often quite sort of women's stories as well, I think, fairy tales.
Good morning, Little Red Riding Hood.
Good morning, how do you do?
Where are you going, Red Riding Hood?
What's in the basket? Something good?
I'm bringing Grandma cakes and wine. She's awful, awful sick. I'm in a great big hurry, too. I've got to get there quick.
There's danger in them woods. Beware, the big bad wolf is lurking there.
Who's afraid of the big bad wolf? Big bad wolf, big bad wolf. Who's afraid of the big bad wolf?
The girl in the red coat and images. Now, that came to you, really, as an image first, didn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. And I think the second book did as well. I'd had an image of, with the doll funeral, of a young girl running out into a back garden, a sort of unkempt back garden. So it was like a camera shot, almost, so from behind, and running out and just touching the tops of the grasses in this unkempt garden and just singing her heart out. That was the jumping off point for that. So, yeah, I think images are very important.
And both of those, it seems to me, come as if they might have been a documentary. So certainly your early work had some
Yes,
bearing.
I think so. I think so. And just being immersed in films as well and what, you know.
Let's just have a look. The Girl in the Red Coat is about a girl, Carmel, who becomes separated from her mother at a local children's festival. And she's found by this man as who claims to be her estranged grandfather. And the story takes off from there. And it all changes. The mother goes from grief to some kind of acceptance. Carmel starts off as a young girl, as an eight-year-old. Mm. And, of course, then we see her grow. And all of that means that this wonderful voice that you've found changes.
Yeah, absolutely. And changes in all sorts of ways, I think. I'm always interested in the sort of trajectories of life that are unexpected and unexpected consequences and ways of developing. And certainly at the beginning, Carmel and her mother are reaching that stage in their relationship where they're getting a little bit scratchy and push me, pull you. And I, you know, mothers and daughters, I think this is, it's something I'm really interested in. And this kind of the reality of the relationship, that it's not this hearts and roses and chocolate box relationship that it's often made out to be, I think. And I wanted to write about something a little bit more complicated than that. So, I mean, that relationship is very sort of cruelly torn apart, but how they both develop then is probably the heart of the story.
Mm. Now, also part of the story is a cult religion. Mm. And without giving really anything away from the book, I know that a member of your own family's been involved in a cult.
Yeah. Yes, quite some time ago. One of my sort of forebears in the 18th century, I think, started her own cult, which was quite successful by all accounts. She actually claimed to be bearing the new Messiah. Her name was Joanna Southcott, and I think she amassed quite a number of followers. And I think there was some kind of society still going in the 1970s even that kind of espoused her beliefs. But yeah, so there's a little bit of form there.
So could you in fact be related to the new Messiah if she wore him?
Well, if her story was true... I don't think she ever managed to produce him, I don't think.
Let's go on to your very latest book, because it's just come out. It's The Doll Funeral. And it's about Ruby and her parents, except they're not her real parents, and what happens to her. Mm. And hunting for her real parents and the very, very odd circumstances that she finds herself in. There are echoes of the previous book just in all the themes we've discussed, but it's very different, isn't it?
I think it has its similarities and it has its differences. again, it kind of has a young girl at the heart of it and her quest to find her own identity, I think. And those are things that are that run through both books, I think. Yes, it's about Ruby. The first chapter opens on her 13th birthday and she finds out for the first time that she's adopted. Her adoptive parents have decided to tell her. And this is where the image comes in, because she runs out into the garden and just sings for joy, because her life up to that point has been really quite brutish and difficult. And so it begins the sort of quest to find her real parents. And in doing so, she starts uncovering all sorts of family secrets in her own family and in other people's families.
Mm. Yeah. And there's quite a lot of otherworldliness, I'm going to say. Again, I don't want to issue a plot spoiler, yeah. but there's quite a lot of life beyond life, if
yeah.
you like.
Yeah, there is. I was really interested in how the past and the present interact and how they kind of resonate and vibrate with each other. And that's really why the book unfolds in the way that it does. I think there's also a theme of, does the past determine who you are, or are you able to actually sort of move that round like you would changing the scenery in a play or something like that? Is that possible to do that? And that's a very strong message or a theme through the book.
Mm. Do you edit as you go along? Are you constantly revising your own work, or do you just write in one big block and then work with an editor?
I have a crazy system in that I write, then I go back at the beginning of every day and review and edit what I've done from the beginning. And as you get further in, it just gets completely untenable because you're just going back to the beginning. And so I discipline myself. When I get further in, I think, right, I won't start at chapter one. I'll start in chapter three or something like that. But yeah, massively editing. And I wouldn't even like to say how many times it's been edited.
And in terms of working with an outside editor, because of course once you've submitted the book, then your publishers will put their own editor into it. Is that difficult? Is it sometimes an uneasy relationship having somebody who hasn't actually written the book telling you how it ought to be?
Do you know, I wondered how it was going to be before we actually embarked on the edit for the first time. But I really enjoyed it, and I think it's a really good part of the process. What I found is that the editor, it's not about changing the book. It's not about saying, you know, get rid of this, that's wrong, or, you know. It's about developing and honing what's there. And I actually think I enjoy that part of it probably more than any of it, because I've had two different editors, Sarah Savitt for the first book and Louisa Joyner for the second, and they've both been brilliant and brought different things to the book. But you can feel it getting better. You can feel the book getting better as you're working with the editor, and I think with good editors, that's how it should be.
Absolutely. Once that process is over, of course, then there's the whole thing of pushing it out there, doing the author tours, all of the PR. And now, with your first book, your publishing house was very clever. There was a big PR push behind it. Tell me about that.
Yeah, I mean, Faber have been a really extraordinary publisher, and for the first book, they all dressed in red coats, the women in the office, and went out with samplers and gave them out at tube stations, the first chapter in a sample. So they got behind it in a very imaginative way.
Which is huge for a debut novel.
Yeah, yeah, it is. It is. But I think a debut novel's quite, because you've never done it before. So, you know, it's not in a blur, but, you know, kind of things are just coming at you all the time. So you're not quite sure what's ordinary and what's not ordinary, I suppose, when you haven't done it before. But they've just been very imaginative, I think, in the way that they've marketed both books.
Yeah. And in terms of a book becoming a bestseller, as indeed yours did, does it always have to have that push?
I think probably not, no. But obviously it's going to help. And if you have got a publisher that's willing to really, you know, put their back into it, that's fantastic. But I think books take off for all sorts of reasons.
Mm. Now, it's all very glamorous and very exciting. But in fact, you live in Cardiff, which may indeed be a glamorous place. I've not been there for many years. But it's hardly the epicentre of the literary universe.
No, that's to be fair. And do you know what? I mean, in some ways, I quite enjoy, you know, that kind of... And no, I mean, if you could see me at my computer, like with my old cardigan on that I tend to seem to wear for writing, and it is really, really not glamorous at all. Surrounded by empty coffee cups and with my cat like curled up on all the drafts on the floor. Yeah. Glamour is not the word that springs to mind.
Now, in between these two novels, of course, you had a book of short stories, The Book of Unwritten Rules. Tell me a bit about that.
That was an anthology. Everybody on the Curtis Brown course, we wanted to do something together because, you know, we've become quite sort of, we've known each other for quite a few good years now and still meet up. We had a Christmas do and all this sort of thing. And we very much wanted to produce something together. So everybody on the course submitted a short story, and it's a collection. And what I really love about it is it's just so different, every story in there, because... we've got very different writing styles, come from different places, different backgrounds. So they are wildly different, the short stories. And actually, when I read short stories, that's what I really love.
Mm. Can you read other people's work while you're writing your own work?
Yeah, I find it essential, actually. I did an event with a crime author, a really successful crime author, and she said when she was first published, she stopped reading and has never read fiction since she began. And I think that's really unusual. I think that's fascinating. But I certainly find I probably read more when I'm writing than when I'm not writing. I think I just try and read stuff I think that is so good that it's going to give me, you know, I think, well, you know, give me something really huge to aspire to because this work is just so good. So, yeah, I read hugely when I'm writing.
And what about books that pertain to what you are writing? Because, of course, both stories have some resonance in real life. Children go missing all the time, for instance, in terms of the girl with the red coat. Real life sort of things that run parallel to your plots. Is that problematic?
I've taken different approaches in both books, actually. With The Girl in the Red Coat, I made a really conscious decision not to read real life cases and not to draw on real life cases. And I wanted it to be Carmel and Beth's own story. That's partly why. But I also didn't want to sort of just trawl and kind of, it was a kind of respect thing, I think, as well. I didn't want to use real life details in the book. With the doll funeral, there's a particular health thing in it. And I did read very widely around that because I wanted that to be absolutely correct. Mm. Not huge amounts of literature about it, but I probably read what there was.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on my third novel and really, really having a good time.
And that's what you're going to say.
Yeah.
But people can read your first and indeed your second. Your first, The Girl in the Red Coat. The second, The Doll Funeral, both published by Faber and Faber. Kate Hamer, thanks so much indeed.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Meet the Writers, thanks to producer Claire Urban and Kieran Banerjee. You can download this show and previous episodes from our website or our app from SoundCloud, Mixcloud or iTunes. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.